Hello and welcome to the LRM podcast in association with Britpart, a podcast where we get together and talk about all things Land Rover and everything that's involved with owning them. I'm Martin Dominey.
And I'm Steve Miller.
And we're going to talk today about, do you know what, actually, we're not going to talk today about that. Today, I've had enough of technology. I've spent the entire morning trying to transfer, I might get too into it, but computers are doing my head in at the moment.
Everything technically does your head in.
That's not true, but
you're happy with a spanner in your hand.
Things
than an SD card.
Unnecessarily complicated, and I've had enough. But it did get me thinking about engines and Land Rovers in general and how different they are now to how they were 20, 30 years ago. It's you're getting a new Defender now, or a Range Rover, or any of the latest Land Rovers, and it is like being, you know, compared to the older stuff, like a spaceship. Everything's touch screens, everything's You know, head up displays. And while, you know, obviously the sort of buyers that are going after them now want all that stuff, because and then Land Rover have got to include it in their cars to keep up with the competition, that it's so far removed from, you know, what we used to be used to, I suppose.
Yeah, that's easy. I can sum it up right now. The best engine, I'm gonna put it out there, ever made by Land Rover is a 2.5 litre naturally aspirated.
You are out of your mind. On what basis?
I don't even think one of those would pull the new Range Rover along.
No, well,
it wouldn't even run its electronic.
You'd be
all seated in horse power.
All of it would be going powering the alternator to keep all the systems up, wouldn't it? But
No, I joke. I don't think it's the best engine. It's the second best engine.
Go on. What's the best then? Tell me.
Well, everyone knows that. It's the one that they have in their vehicle right now.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, it's like when someone asks on social media, what is the best tyre? And then everyone gives...
Everybody just ever recommends
the one they've got. Yeah, exactly.
Because it was their choice.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a delicate balance between usability and a decent amount of power and still being able to maintain it and fix it yourself. I think there's a sweet spot in pretty much every brand's timeline, if you like, where it's good enough to use every day now, but you can also pretty much look after it without too much trouble. And then it goes too far the other way and it's lovely and refined and all those, you know, economical and all those things, but you wouldn't dare go near it at home. And at the other end of the scale, you've got things that are almost dangerously underpowered now. But
like the 2.5 naturally aspirated diesel.
Well,
I have to say, or had that engine in my early 90s, that's now been converted to 300 TDI power from a Discovery.
Yeah.
And a bit of a headwind on the A1, I'd be down into fourth gear and the lorries were overtaking me.
Yeah.
You just could not keep up with any headwind. You were down to 50 miles an hour, which just isn't enough in today's.
It's funny because obviously back when they were new, they were sort of, they probably were still underpowered compared to what the competition were doing, but they were acceptable and, you know, low range, you could still use it off-road, no problem, and you could tow with it because people weren't in such a rush all the time. But now, like you say, as soon as you get to a bit of a hill or whatever, it's...
When the naturally aspirated engine came out, what was its competition? So that's your four-track early one?
Yeah, it would have
been. Litre diesel? Long-term?
2.5 or 2.8, weren't they?
Mm.
But there must have been something in those.
There was an aspirated 2.8, and I remember there was a turbo version.
Right. But those must have been reasonable engines because people fitted them to Land Rovers.
Yes. I remember an old boss of mine had, and this was a 1988 Daihatsu 4-track, almost like a high capacity, long orbit.
Yeah, yeah.
And that had a 2.8 non-turbo engine in it.
Right.
It was so much better than the Land Rover that I owned.
Yeah. I could
at the time. Which incidentally was a 2.5 litre diesel engine in a Series 3. So the 5-bearing crank engine.
Right.
In a Series 3. So I had direct comparison at the time. And although the Daihatsu felt lighter to drive.
Yeah.
It, guarantee you now that car will not be here today.
Well, the bodies and the chassis on those crumbled and you were left with an engine basically, which is why, another reason I suppose why they were so good as a conversion to a Land Rover. But if you look back at all these sort of old Nissan engines, things like that. There was a conversion pretty much for any period power plant, if you like, even the old Perkins engines, which were, you know.
That's the old Montegos.
Perkins Prima, yeah.
Prima diesel.
Yeah, the turbo diesel as well, I believe.
Are they?
Oh, I can't remember. Yeah, some were turbo.
The later Montego
Countrymen and things like that. You could slap them in series Land Rovers all over the place and they did really well.
Because you don't see
a Montego.
Montego Countryman anywhere. They're
in dust now, aren't they?
Good reason.
I bet the engines are still about, though. I bet some are still around, whether they're in Land Rovers or in the corner of someone's garage. But, I think I can. It seems like only yesterday people were all up in arms and moaning that the TD5 was too complicated and the military didn't want it because it had an ECU and people were scared of it. And now you can go on the internet and within 5 minutes buy a complete wiring loom and ECU kit that you can fit that engine in absolutely anything you want and make it run on a pallet if you want to. So it just shows how far technology's come, really.
Well, look at my TD590 when it broke down late last year, September, October time, and it needed the overlay loom, wasn't it? You did it in the and featured it in the magazine?
Yeah, the throttle pedal overlay, wasn't it?
Yes, yeah. So there was a break in the wire somewhere that ran over the top of the gearbox, and, you know, that would have been, forums would have been full of TD5 breaks down technology, but it was a simple matter of unpicking the wires in the ECU, the cable there. Would you say the cable or the...
Yeah, so you just deep hit. You found a supplier, didn't you, on eBay, actually, that had the connector for the throttle with all the pigtails already on it. Just follow the same path as the original and pin it into the ECU, and it's fine, wasn't it?
But it's interesting, though, that car has let me down twice, and it's the only Land Rover that's actually broken down, and yet I consider it a really reliable vehicle. But twice it's been throttle related, and that's all to do with ECU.
Yeah.
Levelings. If I was in the middle of Morocco, I'd have been in a bit of a pickle.
Yes. There's no substitute in my mind for mechanical injection on, you know, an engine that only needs 12 volts to the stop solenoid to run. That's it. I think for complete dependability, no matter what people say, modern stuff is, you know, more reliable than it was, but you're always going to find a way out of trouble, aren't you, with one of those engines? There's not...
No, definitely.
You could take the stop solenoid out, which obviously stops diesel getting to the injector pump. You could take that out completely, take the guts out of it. The engine would still run. You'd have to stall it or whatever if you wanted to stop it, but there's really nothing that will stop one running.
So that's probably why the army wanted to refurbish all their 300 TDIs.
Probably
because they're very easy for them to work on in the field.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, there's not much. And they're very basic tools as well to work on stuff like that.
You do a head gasket on a 300 TDI, and well, I can't.
You could.
A couple of hours?
Not much time at all. They're very, very user friendly. You haven't even got to touch the timing on a TDI to change the head gasket. They're really, really nice and simple. I personally think the 200 TDI is probably the best engine ever fitted to a Land Rover.
I've never owned a 200 TDI.
Yeah, I've had...
only ever owned 300 TDIs.
Two 200 TDIs and a couple of 300s and Discoveries. And to drive and to use, there's not a lot between them. The 200... people say the 200's a bit harsher, but if the valve clearances, the tappets are set properly and it's well serviced, it's still a very smooth engine. The only thing that pips it for me on the 200 is the water pump position. So on a 300, the water pump's really high up. And if you get any sort of coolant loss, you don't have long before the water pump gets starved and it, you know, stops flow and sort of cooks things. Whereas the 200, you're going to realise you've got a leak long before it runs out and, you know, the water pump stops flicking coolant around the engine. Obviously, the downside is the 200 is older and it's a lot harder to get bits for now than the 300.
You still do find 300 TDIs, but often out of Discoveries only, Discovery ones.
Yeah, Discovery one, late Range Rover, but most people are saving those now. But
I don't think the 300 TDI suits the classic Range Rover at all.
See, I think... this is the other thing, is recently, in sort of more recent times, I've really come round to petrol engines. And I think Range Rover, all the Range Rovers suit a petrol better.
Is it? Yeah, all goes hand in hand. It's smooth, it's luxurious, it's... Who cares about fuel economy when you've got a V8?
Well, exactly. I mean, the TD V8 sort of rewrote that a little bit because they are, especially the 4.4, just amazing, lovely and responsive and smooth. But the earlier stuff, if you walked over to a Range Rover Classic and fired it up and it, you know, had a little puff out of the exhaust and then a diesel four-cylinder, not quite the same as sparking up a nice 369 or something, is it?
No, definitely not. Definitely not. If you're going to have a classic Range Rover, I think my money would be on the V8.
Yeah.
Petrol. Yeah. Do you remember the VM diesel in classic Range Rovers?
I've had very little to do. I've actually successfully evaded VMs quite well over the years. I went to look at one once to buy it. It was such a rubbish description on Facebook that I didn't actually know what engine it was. It just said diesel. So I went and had a look and it was half in a hedge. I could barely get the bonnet open.
Best place to leave that, I think.
Someone bought it. I didn't. But the VM was slated, wasn't it? I think the first review, was it Top Gear, possibly? Someone really, really put the...
Probably Clarkson.
No, it wasn't. It was before his time.
Sounds like Quentin Wilson.
No, I think it was before his time. Wow. The VM was sort of... It was tested by Land Rover on... Was it Millbrook Bowl, where they got an average fuel consumption?
Oh, yeah, they would have, quizzed it around there.
But anyway, yeah, Top Gear journalist got into it and basically said, I think they had a fault with the vehicle, which was probably played a big part in the horrific review it got, but it wasn't a fantastically reliable engine. It was...
I've never driven one. Can't possibly comment. I wonder how many of our listeners own a VM diesel Range Rover. I honestly do not know anybody that has one.
I would imagine they're quite collectible now because so many got pulled out and got retrofitted with TDIs.
Mm,
so if there is any out there, then get in touch. Cause
try and put one in a magazine.
Wouldn't mind going to have a look. Yeah, I believe they're, because they're an Italian engine, marine engine, and they're all separate cylinder heads.
It's so long since I've had anything to do with or seen one for probably 25 years.
Yeah, I can believe it. It's a rare engine and only getting rarer, I would imagine.
It's like, talk about Range Rovers. I had the pleasure, no, not really a pleasure, but a mate of mine, we'll call him Farmer David, which I used to keep my Land Rovers in his small holding. And he had three P38s. He had a 4 litre, a 4.6, and then for economy, he bought a diesel. And the 2.5 litre diesel. And I mean, he's in his 70s and he doesn't go far. I mean, he certainly doesn't drive fast. And he called me up one day and he asked me to go and have a look at it and to just test drive it to find out what was wrong. And I couldn't find anything wrong with it. And my mechanic, best mate Pete, couldn't find anything wrong with it. It just transpires that is how slow they actually are.
Yeah, I mean, that engine, the BMW M51, as it's called, the 2.5 straight six, was really developed for 3 and 5 series saloon cars. It wasn't really designed to go in the P38. That shows because you have to, you know, get written permission to pull out of junctions, you know, get plenty of warning in advance. People obviously then came out with tuning boxes and chips to sort of wake them up a little bit, but the cooling system was probably on the limit of its capacity. It's limited by the engine and how hard it was working. So as soon as you chuck more fuel and boost down, it didn't respond that well and hence would crack and things like that. But I've got a couple of friends who've had them and still own them now. And as long as you sort of respect what they are, they're pretty dependable. And of course, P38s as well seem to be, for the most part, holding up against rust better than most contemporaries even.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever seen a rotten one. I think when the P38 came out, again, the technology of engines, the technology of vehicles was an issue. And now they're fairly simplistic cars, aren't they? I mean, you always get that familiar bong when you look at the ignition and there's something wrong with it. But inevitably there will be. But they're still very, very simple in comparison to, say, a modern Range Rover.
Absolutely, yeah. It's going back to that sort of big divide now. Even though the P38 came out, it's bristling with technology that, you know, was way ahead of its time and perhaps not developed as well as it should have been before it went on public sale. You look at that compared to now, it's like comparing a Sega Mega Drive with a, you know, latest PS5 or whatever. It's
the graphics pack, isn't it?
Yeah, a lot of it isn't, but because there's everything is so well documented now, you can fix them at home.
Yeah, no, and fixing it you will, certainly with a P38.
The thing is, though, I've only ever owned one P38, and it was, I bought it because it was just very, very cheap, and it was not a very nice car. It had been converted to coils, and it rode horribly. But when they are nice, they are really nice. Well, I was at Gaydon earlier on this year at the British Motor Museum, and the number of beautifully turned out P38s, it really did get me thinking, oh, this might be...
It's kind of an empty point, isn't it? So like a Range Rover ownership now.
It is.
They're still not... The suits.
You're sort of standard models, so SEs, HSEs, things like that. The 4.6s seem to bring a bit more of a premium over the 4-litre and the diesel, but the any limited edition, so like Bordeaux, certainly Holland and Holland,
the
really nice stuff, really does make decent money now. So, but again, they're a usable classic, aren't they? You wouldn't get out of one of them and feel tired. Not like a series or anything like that. They're luxurious.
Just floats along.
Mm. Does
only 4.6 suffer from, like, porous blocks? Certainly with LPG, a lot of people put LPG on those.
They had their issues. I think the main issue was slip liner. So the cylinder liner would move and then you'd get burning coolant, things like that. Okay. And because of the emissions stringence at the time, they were tuned to run really lean when they were cruising and things like that. So that meant excess heat in the combustion chamber and that, you know, didn't help matters either. But most people who are looking to like get a P38 and keep it long term will either have had an engine with what's called top hat liners. So the liners have a sort of extra bit of meat at the top, if you like, that stops them dropping down. They're machined into the top of the block.
Do they do that with the K series, the 1.8? Didn't that have a similar issue?
No. Well,
liners.
Oh yeah, the liners were the same problem. Yeah, they would drop. It wasn't until I did my turbocharged Freelander a few years ago that I realised that you could actually use an engine with drop liners. You just fitted a different head gasket, and it was all a little bit of a grey area. It was all a little bit like, that doesn't quite seem right. Because people say if you get coolant loss on a K-Series, you fit the latest head gasket, which is a multi-level steel one.
Yeah. And an alarm for the coolant.
Yeah, you can get a coolant level sensor, and there's a few other bits you can do. But if you've got a K-Series that's losing coolant or burning it, and you think it's got a head gasket con, if you check the liner heights, because they obviously drop in comparison to each other.
Okay.
You actually fit the older type head gasket, the silicon with the orange bits around it, and that sort of flexes a bit more and takes up a bit more of the tolerance. It was eye-opening to me, because I just thought, if you've got an engine with a liner that sits low, surely you would just start with another engine. But apparently not.
Okay.
They keep soldiering on.
We heard it here first. Yeah.
Well, yeah.
You've probably fixed quite a lot of Freelanders with that nugget of information.
Well, I certainly fixed my my blue one that I had, and that's still going now with the turbo on the 1.8 litre petrol engine, and comes to quite a few events.
Yeah, I've owned a couple of Freelanders, both TD4s.
Okay.
Good engine.
Yeah, absolutely.
Obviously a bit quieter and a bit more refined than the L-Series?
Yeah, the L-Series.
That was basically a Montego engine, wasn't it?
It came from that lineage somewhere along the line. I was actually talking to Ed Evans this morning about he's got an early Freelander with the L-Series diesel in it.
Yes, yes.
Tech editor of Land Rover Monthly. Ed, he documented his bringing that back from the brink almost of death and then fixing it up, making it nice again. And he loves driving that. They have a real character, the early Freelanders. They have a certain sort of charm to them. And I think that diesel engine is part of it, because it is a bit rough and ready, but really dependable.
Just fill it with diesel and crack on.
Off you go.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly.
So have you ever owned a Land Rover with any conversions? And like the wrong engine then?
Well, my current Series 3 has a V8 that it didn't come out of the factory with. That's a 101 engine. But as far as engines from other manufacturers, I don't think I have, no.
I've owned one.
Go on.
It was a lightweight.
Okay.
Series 3. with a 3 litre Steve Parker converted Ford Essex engine.
Oh, nice. I've heard they're really good match.
Really, really good match. And that thing, same gearing as original, so quite low. And I was young. And yeah, most of the tyre treads left on the ground. So it was literally with wheels spinning first, second, third,
really?
Fourth gear. Yeah, on a damp road. In put it into four on a damp road that would wheel. I mean, I was very young. And really revvy, great thing off-road. Fantastic.
Oh, yeah, I've never actually driven one. I've heard good things about the conversion, and obviously it was quite popular back in the day.
And the engine sat really, because it wasn't so front heavy, the engine sat really close to the bulkhead.
Yeah.
So you'd get a lot of heat from the manifolds in the footwell. Remember, you never put the heating on in that vehicle because it was just constantly warm.
Underfloor heating.
And basically from the manifolds. And I remember it liked a bit of a drink. It wasn't exactly most economical.
Well, I shouldn't think it was if you were spinning it up in every gear.
Well, what do you do?
What you do when you're young?
19 years old.
Well, exactly. But of course now, engines like that are a sort of a distant memory, unless you've got one that's sort of a bit of a survivor. People are chucking all sorts of engines in Land Rovers now, aren't they?
Modern BMW engines.
Yeah.
Cummins engines.
Mercedes, OM engines. People are... I went to a dyno day last year, actually, at Shropshire Automotive. I got it in a magazine.
Oh, of course, yeah.
It's
on YouTube.
It is on YouTube, yeah. The Ultimate Callout Challenge. It was Tom, the guy who invited us there.
Tom Davis.
Yes, with the big Cummins 110. He put the event together, and really, really good turnout. Loads and loads of different sort of combinations, engines, gearboxes, you know, different models they were in. It was really eye-opening, actually.
Do you remember, you might not remember, this is before you joined the LRM team. we did the world's fastest Land Rover. Probably talking 15, 16 years ago. And the Hyde Bunting Fall.
I remember that feature.
And, you know, some of the guys like Alive Tuning were there, Twisted. Which he still owns that car. It was a black 90 hardtop, and that won.
Right.
The fastest, that was a TD5, and I've actually driven that car.
That was back when all of Twisted were really hardcore.
Twisted,
it was all Hurricane and Tornado and things that were named after wind.
That's right, correctly. Yeah.
But no, I do remember that, and there was
Alive Tuning.
Was at the time, would have been TD5 Alive.
Probably. TD5 Alive, yeah. God, these are old names.
I know. This is
Ian Bourne was there. Abatements, I believe.
Keith Bell? Was he there?
I don't know.
Bell Autos.
Bell Auto Services, probably. A lot of people took part.
It was big business, wasn't it? It still is. Still is. People doing very well off the back of tuning TD5s. And, you know, there's a lot of people out there, myself included.
Well, as I mentioned, probably in episode one of the podcast, I had my own TD5 remapped. I've never had a vehicle remapped in my life, but towing a 700 kilo trailer just needed a bit more, and I had one done at Empire Tuning at the LRM Live Malvern show.
There's so much that you can do with them now, especially that first jump, I think, as I was explaining to you the other day, between the standard map, if you like, the standard calibration in the ECU and what a lot of people refer to as like a stage one, like a mild tune.
Which is kind of what I've got.
Yeah, I mean, that's where you don't have to change anything else. You literally...
Totally legal. Still got all the EGR on there. Still got the CAT. Still got everything.
Yeah, all the emissions.
That's factory.
Intact.
Yeah.
Standard is
just a remap.
Exhaust is the same, just a remap. That jump, I think, is the biggest jump you get, is from nothing to that initial map. And it really does wake everything up. Probably one of the first modifications you should do, really, if you're looking for a little bit more poke. But a TD5, even in standard trim, will get along the road, you know, modern traffic. You can cruise at legal speeds.
Really can. I mean, 70 in a standard TD5 always sounds a bit, or feels a bit rushed. 60 is better.
Yeah, unless you go gearing it up, but then you are going to want more power, because otherwise you're going to be, you know,
suffering on the accelerator.
Struggling a little bit. But, so you're... I suppose now your trailer's pretty much, it's movable, isn't it?
Yeah, usable. Not just movable.
Not just movable.
Yeah. Ready to go camping at any moment.
You're 90 with the 300 conversion. That needs to be next on your list of things to crack on with, really.
I know. It's just time. Lack of it. But yeah, I've got everything sitting there in the garage, rolling chassis, 300 TDI. I've obviously driven that engine, that vehicle with
the old converted chassis before you took it apart.
Now, that's the biggest power boost you can ever get. Because that was 62 horsepower to standard 111.
Yeah. So double,
pretty much double the horsepower with the same gearing. I've never been so gobsmacked by the stark difference.
Yeah, such a nice... to me, that's sort of the package I would have, really.
Better fuel economy.
Yeah, you're not strangling it all the time. You can get up to speed and hold that speed without downshifting into third every time you get to a mild incline.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's good. TDI for me is the way forward. People, you know, the TD5 has its real staunch. You're a TD5 man. And I get the TD5.
I like the sound of it. I think it's the closest to a V8 petrol.
Oh,
because it's distinctive.
Yeah, they are. Five-cylinder engines do sound good.
Yeah.
But it's just not as nice and linear and smooth, I don't think, as a TDI. And I like the feel of a throttle cable.
I am with you on that, because it's all very... you haven't got the mechanical aspect when it goes on to tick over. Mm. More noticeable when I owned a Discovery 2 TD5.
Right.
I owned it for about 8,000 to 10,000 miles, which was about probably 6-7 months of driving. That was an auto box, and I wasn't so keen. Felt really underpowered in that.
Yeah, I think whichever way you look at it, obviously with a manual, you've got that mechanical connection all the time between the engine and the rest of the driveline, whereas with an auto, it's always going to sap that low end.
It always seemed to be revving and not actually going.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, some of my most reliable motoring has been in 300 TDIs in a Discovery 1. I've owned two of those. In fact, I've owned three of them. And in fact, I've owned four of them. But anyway, long story. But two of them, which I did, over the two vehicles, 100,000 miles, not once did that engine let me down. Just serviced every 10,000 miles, changed your oil, checked on a few bits and pieces, and just kept going.
Yeah, they're ever so good. And even, especially over in Europe and further afield, the mileages people get out of TDIs without any significant work, very, very impressive. Like 500,000 kilometres on a standard unopened engine that's had maintenance, and that's about it.
Well, the engine that's in my rolling chassis, when that came, you may remember this, we did a feature called Grand Rover.
We
all went out and bought Land Rovers with our own money. No big publishing budgets, but our own money. So I purchased a 300 TDI Discovery with, I think he had like 170,000 miles on the clock. Anyway, that vehicle inevitably got broken because I wanted it for the parts of the vehicle for my 90. We took the head off that TDI to replace, while the engine's sitting there, I had to replace a gasket. And the balls had zero wear.
Yeah.
At 170,000 miles. It was like a new engine.
Properly well put together.
Yeah. So is that the ultimate Land Rover engine then? The 300 and 200 TDI?
Well, if you're talking standard out of the box, yeah, I think it probably is. But...
you've opened a can of worms then.
Probably. I'm willing to light that touch paper and walk away. I think it's the right thing.
Yeah, we can't walk away. You're the editor of the biggest Land Rover magazine in the world.
Oh, that's true. However,
you've just put that out there.
I'm fine with it. I'll stand by that. But obviously, the market now, with especially the more expensive end of the Defender modification, restoration type thing, everyone's like, no, forget Land Rover engines. There's plenty more stuff out there. And there's, you know, the go-to at the moment seems to be the BMW M57, the straight six. That's a nice fit.
I do like the look of that conversion.
Yeah.
I've not driven one yet. I would like to drive one.
Yeah, they're good. I've driven a couple, a manual and an auto, a couple of autos. And especially now they're using the 8-speed gearbox as well. Mm. It's a really, really versatile sort of... And they're pretty much... you can make them as fast as you want them. They are very, very remappable. They do a twin turbo version. You can get serious, serious power out of them now.
Do you think, though... I remember it's... having a visit to JE Engineering, now JE Motorworks, and we went out in one of their demo 110s.
Oh, was it like one of the Zulus?
Zulus.
Yeah. Also, 5 litre.
Yeah. Supercharged.
Oh, really?
I believe it was supercharged.
Yeah, that does make...
Yeah, it was supercharged.
Yeah.
And I have never been. We were on private roads and driven by a chap called Colin Musgrave. He's like a Vases Morgans.
Oh,
he used to be their PR guy, and he took us out. And our old who wasn't editor, he was our deputy editor. He was in the back, and we've never been so scared. We were limited by the fact that the amount of air hitting the front windscreen could have put the windscreen in.
Really?
He said, we can't go much faster because it's an aerodynamics of a brick, and it was the quickest...
Terminal velocity.
Yeah, the quickest Defender I've ever been in. And I knew... I mean, no one's going to drive it like that all of the time, but...
Yeah.
Just defied, like...
The thing people... jump on, and they're not wrong, as they say, well, if you're adding more power, you need to upgrade the brakes and the suspension.
Everything was upgraded on that car.
Yeah. But I do think, and don't quote me on this because it's maybe not the right attitude to have, but a Defender is designed to have 750 a ton in the back and tow 3.5. It's fairly overbraked from the factory. That's not to say you shouldn't upgrade the brakes, but the standard brakes, especially on 110s and things with bigger calipers, they do the job quite well. As soon as you go to things, silly things like 5 litre.
I think if you're on the track or something like that and those brakes get really...
Oh, yeah, they will. You'll cook them easily. But for road use...
I don't think... Yeah. I remember feeling the benefit of upgraded brakes on that particular car.
Yeah, sure.
That's probably the most... Not scared, but most exciting Land Rover I've ever been in.
I tell you, it's funny you should mention V6s, actually. I did an article on it was a 90 fitted with a 3.7 litre Ford V6 modern engine at Motor and Diesel a few years ago.
3.7.
I'm sure it's 3.7. Yeah, it's what came in, what was it? I forget the exact model that it came with over in the States, but they were importing these engines and doing the kit to fit them, keeping the 6-speed box from the Puma, from the TDCI. And it was such
a Ford Mustang engine. Isn't
it might be.
The Ford Mustang, they did the V6 one.
It must be. I think it is.
You should never buy. You should go straight to the V8.
Well, yeah. I think it was called a TCIE or something. I can't remember the car.
It'll be a good engine for that.
What I can remember is how lovely it was to drive. It was about 300 brake, 300 horsepower, decent amount of torque. And it was like a V8, but not... You didn't have to be quite as careful with it. You know, like when you drive a high-powered V8 Defender or a high-powered V8 anything, you have to sort of really sort of modulate your foot.
Yeah, you have to
keep an eye on your speed all the time. This thing felt like you could drive it and be a bit more involved. It was really, really good. I don't know how many they're doing, but yeah, really interesting conversion at the time. And it got me thinking, you know, because being so modern, they were all emissions compliant as well. So ULEZ and all that stuff wouldn't bother it, you'd reclassify it. It was quite eye-opening. But
we're getting to the LS engine.
Yeah.
Which is everyone's
going for it, aren't they? Everyone seems to be slapping that. Well, even now they're doing the newer version, the L83, I
believe. The L80 something, yeah, I think you're right.
Which is, again,
straight crate engine.
Yeah, get one off the States. There's kits all over the place, and you know, lots of companies up and down the UK that will fit it for you and do the calibration, and you can choose manual or auto. There's lots of different ways to
I think I'd go auto with that engine.
Yeah, I think I would,
because you've got two cars in one, then you could just be lazy around town.
Yeah,
let's be honest, most people are in town in those, aren't they?
Well, they are, and they're sort of toys, but well, they seem to be generally used, you know, as pleasure vehicles, and there's nothing wrong with that. But I think, imagine...
Who would have thought of
them for towing?
The Land Rover uses for pleasure.
I
mean, yeah.
It's happening.
It's happening.
They're doing it.
They are. We do it.
Well, yeah. It's...
When the Land Rover first came out, they was never for pleasure.
No, they weren't, no. But a lot of them that you see with like the upgraded suspension, brakes and things like that, you do think, or certainly I think to myself, if it's that good at being driven on the road with nothing in it, imagine how good that would be as a work vehicle. Imagine what you know, how effortless towing would be.
Yeah, definitely. And I bet nobody really tows with them.
I think there's a few of the people with like the Cummins conversions that use them for work, but you very rarely see people.
Engine suited for like.
Well, it's a truck engine.
Logging and, you know, like commercial use. Towing big trailers with plants on it. It's a dump truck engine.
Well, they fitted them to things like the DAF 45, didn't they? That's where most people seem to get them from, yeah. Which are used for like horse boxes and cargo trucks. I think they're 7.5-ton cargo truck, basically. But yeah, yeah.
That's the lorry kind of thing.
Yeah, that may be a bit smaller, but tons and tons of torque. A bit agricultural, as you'd expect from a mechanically injected six-cylinder that's nearly six.
Well, so that's Tom Davies, the founder of the...
I think his is the slightly newer version, but yeah, he's getting serious.
That drew the crowd. When he starts it up, he's had it on one of our stands at one of our spares desks.
I remember seeing
it. It drew a crowd. The minute that bonnet was up, he'd got people around there.
Well, the Cummins fills the engine bay like nothing else. It does look like, you know, it fills it from front to back.
It's a big old lump.
And those, again, funnily enough, individual rocker covers on the Cummins are just so iconic, like the 6BT individual little steel cut caps from front to back. As soon as you see one, you know what it is.
So money, no object then. Which engine would you put in a Defender?
What, non-Land Rover engine?
Yeah.
You've put me on the spot with that question.
Whatever you say right now, some people will agree with you.
Yeah, a lot won't, I don't think.
Yeah.
What would I...
We'll know about it in the comments.
Yeah, probably. That, having driven a couple and sort of looked at them against everything else, I think even though it's all electronically controlled, it would be BMW M57 single or twin turbo. I don't think, given the support and the number of them that have been done now, it's a proven conversion, and everyone who has one, everyone who's driven one's been impressed. So I think I'll go with that.
See, I ought not to agree with you, but I can't help but agree.
Yeah.
BMW do make a good engine. I mean, I know that people might be in a Mercedes camp here.
Yeah, the thing about
Merc diesel.
I've got absolutely nothing against the Mercedes diesel. And I think actually, if you wanted something that you could fix with a spanner, because they're pretty much all mechanically injected with, injection pumps from Diesel Pump UK and, you know, there's other companies that do them. They are brilliant, but they seem to rely a little bit more on revs than the BMW. The BMW seems to have a little bit more low down run. Again, people might have other experiences and opinions on that, but it depends on the weight of the vehicle as well and what you're doing.
I suppose it's not so much a conversion, because if quite rightly, BMW used to own Land Rover.
Yeah.
It's not really a conversion, is it?
Well,
is it the engine that Land Rover should have put in?
Well, they did put it in the Range Rover, didn't they?
Yeah, but in a Defender.
In a Defender. Well, this is another sort of bit of lore, bit of Land Rover background, if you like, is when BMW took over or bought Land Rover, Land Rover was already developing its own range of 4, 5, and 6-cylinder engines. So basically it was going to be a modular sort of TD5 with one fewer cylinder for the Freelander and things like that, and one more cylinder for the Range Rover.
Okay.
BMW came in and went, why are you doing that? We've already got a 4-cylinder and
which six-cylinder.
Which
is the TD4 Freelander engine.
Yeah.
Which was
the TD6 Range Rover. So the 4 and the 6-cylinder engines were scrapped basically, and BMW said, we'll use our own, but they didn't have anything for Defender. So the TD5 for the Defender and Disco 2 lived on.
And that was Land Rover's own engine, not BMW's.
Yeah.
Ah, okay.
And for its time, the TD5 had some really interesting technology. It had, you know, unit injectors. The fuel rail was in the head. There were all sorts of sort of quite quirky things that weren't often seen in sort of passenger vehicle engines. And it was good. But, it could well have been, had BMW not bought Land Rover out, that we would have had a very Land Rover would have made their own TD4 and TD6 that would have been fitted across the range, but no.
Where would we have been without BMW? We wouldn't even have Land Rover today, would we?
Well, I don't know.
Didn't they save?
Who knows? Yeah, probably.
We'll save that.
Had a bit of cash, didn't they? BMW?
Yeah, of course.
Had a bit of cash that they chose not to spend on the Range Rover L322 Have you ever compared underneath a Range Rover of that age, like the early L322 with the X5, which was the period 4x4 from BMW?
I have never looked underneath either of those cars.
It's funny because you look at underneath a Range Rover and then again you look under an X5 and there's so many little areas that you can tell that BMW penny pinched on the Range Rover but didn't on the X5.
So at the time they needed the X5 to be the superior.
Yeah, basically. It's all very, they're very similar underneath. They share a lot of components, things like differentials, transfer boxes, which are, I believe, ZF, but brakes, things like that. There's a lot of crossover between the two. But all the sort of penny pinching was done on the Range Rover. And that really sort of stands out.
It's bizarre, isn't it? Because the L322 versus the similar year, or the same year, X5, the L322 is like timeless.
It should be.
It's class.
Yeah.
It's kind of, it's aged particularly well. The X5 looks, you don't see many X5s now, do you?
There's a few still about. I think the same rule applies across all sort of aging SUVs. They either age with dignity and grace and they're kept nice and standard.
Which is pretty much anything Land Rover and Range Rover have done.
Yeah. So they're sort of kept in nice condition and they're not ruined. And then you get some that are like covered in eBay chrome, you know, mismatched tyres. And they just
spoke about mismatched tyres the other day and the chrome thing on like a Range Rover Sport.
Oh, there is.
It's not great. It's not a great look now. Might have been the news.
Never a great look, Steve.
It's never a great look.
I remember working at the dealership and you'd get these cars in for, so they were often either breakdowns or, you know, faults or whatever, and you'd get them in, put them on the ramp and you'd go, oh, well, it needs this and this, and the owner would get it. And it was quite rare they'd actually have the work done. They'd more often than not pay for the diagnosis of whatever was wrong with it and take it away, even if it was something quite important. And you could sort of tell there's that sort of, as soon as they started to fall into that price bracket of maybe there was an element of champagne taste, lemonade money, and they, you know, maybe struggling to run it. But they were often the ones that were covered in stick-on chrome and, you know, 22-inch shiny wheels with,
they're spending the money on the wrong thing.
Basically.
The wrong parts.
But to me now, when you look at especially things like early Range Rover Sports, like a 55 or 56 plate Sport, if you see one in the right colour with its standard wheels on and not messed with too much, they look so good.
They do look good.
They look really, really nice, even though they are the age they are, you know, approaching 20 years old. Can you believe it's almost 20 years since?
Ed Evans still has one, doesn't he?
Yeah, he is. He still has a TDV6, a silver one. Yeah. And that looks really nice.
That's an 07.
Oh, is it?
I think it's an 07.
But do you know what?
But he can't find it. He's often looked at other things, he said.
Yeah, because like, he was off in Evoque for a bit, wasn't he?
In Evoque, and nothing drives quite how his Sport does.
Yeah.
It's irreplaceable.
They're quite unique. In the Land Rover Range, I always found the Sport to be sort of, not an odd one out, but they were a very unique drive, because as soon as you shut the door, you're in this real sort of tight cockpit. You don't sit, it's not spacious like the L322, but they're almost, they feel really sort of precise and quite nice to drive. You can see why they marketed it as the Sport, even though arguably as a diesel it was a little bit underpowered.
It wasn't a sporting drive, but it was just its
nothing
position. It didn't, it
wasn't sportier than the Range Rover. But I mean, a Range Rover is a sofa with four wheels, isn't it? You don't have to try too hard to make it sportier. But things like the active cornering enhancement, ACE, that really did transform them. When you drove one with that and the big Brembo brakes on the front, you know, for a heavy car, they were really, really nice to drive. For me.
And good value.
No. Well, excellent value now, yeah. If you can find one that has actually been, you know, looked after quite nicely, they are incredible. Same with Discovery 3. Amazingly capable car.
The finest Land Rover, in my opinion, is the Discovery 3 and 4. Having owned a 3,
yeah,
the most, never had a problem with the engine.
Yeah.
And yet, the car kind of needed, because I was 20,000 miles a year in that car.
Yeah.
And that was the most expensive motoring I've ever done.
Yeah.
In terms of repairing the car.
They are, again, they're complex, aren't they? Although, again, the same sort of thing as P38. It's that same, they were quite packed full of tech when they were new, and the tech sort of ages and people, you know, get them out of warranty and have a go at fixing them or don't quite know what to do. And it's, yeah, they can get expensive if you, if you're relying on a garage to do everything there.
And I was, because yeah. You at the time.
Yeah.
I mean, if you could wind the clock back now, Discovery 3 would be in the car park.
Yeah.
You'd be fixed.
I'm quite glad you haven't got one. I'm glad you've got your Defender.
Yeah, you have a weekend to yourself.
Yeah, occasionally. Yeah.
Help.
But they're a cracking car. And yeah.
So Discovery 4, 3 litre V6 diesel.
Yeah.
Crankshafts. Is it a bigger problem? UX dealer.
We did see quite a few, even like low mileage ones. And by the sounds of it, unfortunately, Land Rover haven't really, well, not only have they not acknowledged the problem, and you know, they didn't do that many under warranty. A lot of them were out of warranty or just out of warranty when they failed. But the later generations of Discovery and the Range Rover Sport as well, which the later ones of which I believe it's 2014 on, had the Gen 2. Which is the same base engine, but a few revisions. Apparently, they're just as bad. It's really, it is unfortunate because when they're working, actually, that twin turbo 3 litre V6,
absolutely fantastic,
beautiful engine to drive.
Yeah. To what use. You think? And to tow.
Yeah,
we used one for a little while. But it had a long term test, I think, a few years ago. We had an exhibitions trailer,
right?
Which was let's put it this way, that would have weighed 3.5 tons.
Yeah.
And that pulled it a treat. What a fantastic thing to have.
It was a big,
fantastic engine.
Big leap, really, from the 2.7 to the 3 litre again. And you only got that little bit of extra capacity, but extra turbo. And, you know, especially, again, the later ones with the 8-speed gearbox. Fantastic thing. And, I still do kind of want a Discovery 4.
I wouldn't blame you at all.
I think they're one of my favourite Land Rovers of all time. It's just, I would struggle to own one. It can't, for what I would do with it, it probably isn't that much more capable than the Freelander 2 that I've got. Like, it wouldn't be that much of an advancement in what I would use it for, but I would constantly be awake at night worrying that I would be driving it the next day and out of nowhere the crank would just break.
And you really need £10,000 spare cash as a fund ready for that to happen. Don't you?
Yeah.
Because exactly. That's what an engine now with labour is easily £10,000, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, probably more than that with labour. But the...
Oh, this is £10,000 if you were doing it for me.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because you work for nothing.
Cheap labour, yeah.
Yeah, of course. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, sorry, I keep forgetting. But
I don't build labour into it anymore.
Yeah, you don't have...
I have a Martin.
Yeah, great.
Thanks.
No worries. But no, great cars. And it's just... they don't seem to be having the best luck with engines, even in modern times now. The 2-litre Ingenium. I mean, you don't...
Oh, I've not heard about this.
Yeah, right. The... timing chain problems and things like that, and oil dilution, and it not telling you it needs a service when it's really overdue a service and things like that. I remember PDIing, which is pre-delivery inspection, so when the cars come in brand new, before they go to the customer, you do a PDI. Which
is that not just sticking other plates off?
No, it's not just sticking.
I'm only messing.
But you have to, you do a lot of prep work, you set everything up on the computer, but part of it is you have to do a road test to make sure it drives okay, no noises, things like that. And the first sort of 3 or 4, there was Discovery Sport, I believe, that got the 2-litre Ingenium first, 2016 model year. It'd come back in and there'd be steam pouring from under the bonnet, and it'd like been, it'd blow the coolant pipes off the fuel cooler under the bonnet, and you just
that,
as a, at the time you don't think, you know, oh okay, well maybe they weren't fitted properly, these things happen. But it was a bit of a... it wasn't getting off on the right foot for the 2-litre Ingenium. Unfortunately, they haven't really improved with age. So every time... again, I think about upgrading the Freelander 2 and I think, oh, I'd quite like a Discovery Sport. They're a nice car to drive.
They're okay. I've driven a couple.
I'd only ever buy one with the 2.2.
Which is...
which is...
the Freelander 2 engine.
Barely a, you know, an improvement. It's barely any sort of progression on from the Freelander 2, and it was only available for a year, and everyone wants the 2.2 because it's a great engine.
So what are we saying then? There isn't a modern Land Rover right now that we could own.
There is.
Go on.
New Discovery. Actually, no, I'll expand on that. New Discovery with a petrol Ingenium. They seem quite good.
Good on fuel?
I mean, no. You've got to, you know, so there's a trade-off. There's a trade-off somewhere, Steve. You can't have everything. You can't have an engine that stays together and good fuel economy.
What?
I mean, people don't seem to be having many problems with Defender, petrol, Ingenium. Actually, the 3-litre straight six Ingenium seems to be a lot better than the 2-litre as far as longevity goes.
Yeah, see, I think, just I know, 2-litre to me seems too small for a car of that size.
Yeah, I know what you're saying.
I've driven a 2-litre petrol. Am I making this up? 2-litre petrol Discovery 5.
No, they do one.
They do one,
yeah.
Don't they?
Yeah, yeah. That's the engine I was talking about. They're actually quite good.
Yeah, they drive really well.
Yeah.
However, now I do know about the economy. About 20.
Yeah, I would say that was probably about right.
Yeah, we had one on test a few years ago.
They're lovely, smooth.
When they first came out.
But the 3-litre, like Russ Dykes, who we know, who does the 4x4 tours all over the place.
Yes.
He goes on about how great his Defender 90 is. Until the cows come home, and that he's done serious mileage in that. I think about 40 or 50,000 miles for mostly overland travel, and that's, I believe, the D250, which I think is a 3-litre straight six. It's a six-cylinder Ingenium anyway, and he has had no problems with it as far as I can tell.
Good vehicle.
Yeah. Again, it's not quite to the same extent as the older stuff, the Disco 3 and the TDV6s, because, you know, you're probably still under warranty to an extent anyway. But it's having that backup to know you can get sorted out if you're somewhere remote. And it's having that, you know, if you are out of warranty, you are going to be footing the bill for repairs yourself. So,
which could be substantial.
Could be.
Especially if you're unfortunate.
I have. I don't charge you anything.
Oh, yeah.
I should start.
You should. Don't start.
No, I am going to start. I might get time to do my own projects if I start charging you. But no, I mean, it's a bit of a, not a minefield, but it's, you've really got to make considered choices. And don't forget, and I say this all the time, you only ever hear about the bad ones. No one goes on a forum or on Facebook or on Instagram and, you know, sings the praises of their car they've had 6 years and it's never gone wrong. You only ever hear about the failures.
You see, when this podcast goes out, we could post this on Facebook and ask everybody who's good experience. We could change Land Rover's future by getting everybody that's had good experiences to tell us the good experiences they've had.
Yeah, that's not wrong. We could reverse the narrative. That's what they would say, isn't
yes.
it? Reverse the narrative. But I don't know. It's going to be a few years until I'm in a position to buy a 2-litre petrol Discovery 5 or anything, or a 6-cylinder Defender. But they are lovely, lovely vehicles.
See, I like the new Defender.
Yeah, I do.
They've just held their prices. The trouble is, and this is where I fell into the Discovery 3 thing, when you can afford to buy it secondhand, you can't really afford to run it secondhand because you're then footing the bill of all the sales warranty. You know, someone's had the best of it, and then all of a sudden you're picking up the repair.
It is more difficult. Again, you've got to be really considered and you've got to buy the very best with the best history, regardless of whether that's main dealer or independent. Yeah. You've got to be prepared to spend a few quid, though.
Yeah. Always have an emergency fund.
Yes.
Because you will definitely need an emergency fund.
Relatively. They're not cheap vehicles. They weren't cheap to buy. They might be cheap to buy secondhand.
But not cheap to run.
But not cheap to run. And that's what a lot of people forget, I think.
Come here for consumer advice.
You don't have to listen to it. I mean, I probably wouldn't actually listen to it. But anyway, so feature of the week.
Feature of the week.
Feature of the
what
week.
What have we got?
This is a cool feature. This is a lady called Marie who's driving her Defender 110 all the way around America. She's doing all 50 states in this 110, which she had imported. And what makes this kind of cool is, she didn't actually start in a Land Rover. It took her a little while to actually see the light. She started off in a Subaru I think it was a Subaru Legacy Estate, and it's obviously not quite up to the job of touring. The touring lifestyle is better suited to something decent like a Defender 110, but thankfully she imported one from the UK. She's loaded it up with, you know, she's fairly basic as far as expedition stuff goes. She's keeping it quite low key, yeah. But she's off around America with her dog and having a lovely time by the looks of it. She's called Roaming Reckless. You can look her up on YouTube. She's got a really cool YouTube channel and catch up with what she's doing on there. But you can also read about it in the current issue of Land Rover Monthly. So be sure to check that out.
And what engine has she got in that 110?
I believe it's a 300 TDI.
Good choice.
Yes, indeed. It is of that vintage. It's a P-Reg, I think, so it would be a 300.
Nice.
Yeah.
Very good.
Still on its UK plates as well, which is quite smart, which is quite unusual.
Nice tip.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
I'll just go and just read it. Wondering.
Yeah, you should. It's really just a great story. So, this brings us on to product of the week. And it's a bit of a different one this week, actually, because it's not actually a product for your Land Rover. It's a product that you might have of your Land Rover, which you can put up in your garden to remind yourself just how great the Defender 110 looks. And it is what they call Hanging Gardens of Solihull, which is a bracket. I suppose you could call it a bracket. It's a plant, a hanger to hang a hanging basket from, available from YRM Metal Solutions. And it very smart it is too. It's a laser cut Defender 110, hanger that goes onto a fence or a pole or a post. And it's got a lovely silhouette of a 110 doing a bit of off-roading. And you can hang some lovely plants.
Get your fuchsias hanging.
Get your fuchsias out. And
just flower, I know.
Yeah.
And so, dandelions, that's a flower.
You wouldn't have dandelions in it, would you? They're a little bit like wild flowers. I don't know. This is, we're not
gardeners, are we?
We're not gardeners, no. But I do very much like this, and I would have this in my garden.
I was
very cool,
one,
isn't it?
I have a Land Rover weather vane on my garden.
I've seen it.
It's good.
Do you know what else I've seen people do, actually, talking of gardening and Land Rovers, is Defender rear tubs do their planters. They're cool. They look like the rear quarter of a Land Rover tub, but you can plant things in it.
Yes.
And also, people using old Defender bumpers and series bumpers as flower beds. Fill them up with soil.
That's
what I was flowers thinking. In them. Yeah. Quite smart.
Yeah.
Yeah, all sorts of innovations.
Out of old bits of Land Rover.
Out of old bits of Land Rover. You've got to disguise them somehow, haven't you? You can't just pile them.
Yeah, I wish I could disguise them. The side of my garage looks like an overspill from a Newbury spares wear.
Well, I think that about concludes podcast number 2.
Absolutely.
The LRM podcast in association with Britpart. Thanks again for listening. Don't forget to send your readers questions in editorial@lrm.co.uk, and we will endeavour to answer them on the next one. But once again, thank you for joining us. Goodbye from me.
And goodbye from me.
And we'll catch you on the next one. Cheers.